starting with the circle, taking inspiration from the city's seal and the city's Olympic heritage. It's a symbol of unity and globalization. It represents the never-ending passion for this city and for this club. The five stripes represent the pillars of our character: unity, determination, community, excellence, and innovation. A bold A at the centre of the logo puts the focus on the enduring strength of Atlanta. The A is anchored to the circle, symbolising its connection to the community. The colour black is a symbol of strength and power. Red represents pride and passion. And finally, gold epitomises excellence. This is our city. This is our club. We are Atlanta United FC.
That's a great trip down memory lane. The great John Champion voicing the launch of Atlanta United. That's when we saw our first time of our logo. When we found out we were Atlanta United, it was one of the best nights of my career, and I'm sure Darren as well. But welcome to Spiked Up, episode 6. We got a couple big timers on the podcast today. The great John Champion and Taylor Twellman. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
Great to be with you. We've just about managed to find room in what are totally packed diaries, as you can imagine at the moment.
Good to hear the voice of United. Yeah, just hearing that talk, John, I don't know if you remember, but I'd sort of been hounding you to just do the voiceover. We wanted to have that soccer credibility as we were launching the team, and you kindly found time in your diary. But the only time we could get the studio in London was like 10 o'clock UK time. So we had to get up at 5 a.m. drive to Flowery Branch, which was about an hour north of Atlanta, where our studios are based at the Falcons. And I always remember it. We recorded it, and you're always known for me as one take John Champion, because we just did it first time, nailed it, and we were done. And we were starving. So we went to Cracker Barrel, which is the only place near up in the sticks of the boonies where we were. And the other reason I always remember it is I was looking at the menu and I said to the waitress, "What's red eye gravy?" And she sort of looked at me, thought for a bit, you could see the wheels spinning. She said, "Basically just grease." Didn't really sell it that well. So I was like, "No, I'll skip the red eye gravy then."
Oh, brilliant.
Darren was like, "Where did you take me?" I was like, "Yeah, I got a great spot for breakfast. It's a Cracker Barrel." Yeah, you could not believe where we walked into.
John, the most important thing here is they must have lost my number for the launch, because I rightfully predicted that Atlanta was going to be a hit right from the beginning. And so it's just interesting that they just, you know, somehow found your number but didn't find mine.
Yeah, tell us about that, Taylor. I remember from back then, I mean, give us your perspective. You were surprised with how it went in Atlanta?
I was shocked. Still am. You know, it's interesting, Darren. For a majority of my childhood, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, right? And so, huge Cardinals fan. I was a big baseball player. And you saw what the Atlanta Braves did during that time. They won 14 straight division titles. And yet, Darren, they couldn't sell out until the playoff games. And it was so mind-boggling for someone like myself. Cardinals sold out every game, every night. It was unthinkable if you didn't want to go to a Cardinals game. And so I then saw the history of the Atlanta Falcons. The Hawks have always struggled, you know, ever since Dominique retired. And then the Thrashers struggled. So when they said MLS is going to Atlanta, I literally was like, what are we doing? Like, and I will say but a lot of people were saying that, though, Darren. Like, behind the scenes, so many people in the soccer world were like, I'm not sure this is going to work. So I am so happy to be completely wrong, completely off base. That's a credit to the organization. That's a credit to everyone that's been involved, including yourself. But the history of Atlanta as a sports town hasn't been a professional sports town. Now, college football is completely different. But for professional sports, it's not like history was on its side there. They dominate. They were going to be great. I just am shocked that Atlanta United is actually – the ticket to go to. That's where I've completely been surprised in that sense.
And it's interesting what you say, Taylor, about the college football, because I do think that's the closest analogy to what we have. You know, John will know as well, and sort of rest of the world, that concept, you have one club for life, and that level of loyalty and the atmosphere in the stadium. And so I think probably that was one of the factors that we were able to tap into, that sort of college football psyche, because you've seen it with the tailgates. I mean, it's just it's soccer but with a flavor of almost SEC football around it. And you know, that's been something for me that I sort of never envisaged that happening, because I didn't know about the college football scene. But I do think we're able to tap into that a little bit.
No, but Darren, it's also, and this is ironically, 2020 pandemic's thrown a wrinkle into this. But I was taking, I was going to take John Champion to Athens, Georgia. I wanted to do an Atlanta United game, but before then, go see a college football, because John needs to really experience that and see that. But the one thing that nobody saw coming, and I've talked to so many people outside the sport, is the music culture of Atlanta embracing it. When a cab driver or an Uber driver tells me I'm a complete idiot for my thoughts on the left back of Atlanta United or the inability to defend set pieces, whatever it may be, and then you go to a bar or you go to the culture places of Atlanta and they're talking about Atlanta United, that's where you have to pinch yourself and say, are we sure this isn't a dream?
Yeah, I thought it was cool on the when we hosted the All-Star game. For me, that was quite a good sense, because I'd been actually to the All-Star games even when I was at Tottenham in 14, 15. Yep. So I'd seen the progression, but I felt like that All-Star game was, the whole city was behind it. You know, as you say, you could get into an Uber driver would be talking about the All-Star game. I think that's where we've managed to sort of get the whole focus of the city and the wider metro area.
Absolutely. And John, I've told John this story numerous amount of times. Arthur Blank walked into the booth. He came on for a live interview. He never asked me what I was going to ask. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to take advantage of this. You know me well enough, Darren.
That's not like you.
So I said, what's been the biggest surprise? He didn't even skip a beat. He said, Atlanta Falcons season ticket holders want to buy Atlanta United season tickets and exchange tickets. He didn't see that coming. And that's where you're like, okay, now really, what are we doing?
And of course, Darren, that's the same booth where I enjoyed one of my all-time broadcasting highlights of my entire sort of 30-year plus career, when Taylor and your good self allowed me the privilege of interviewing Jeezy live during a game, which was one of the more challenging interviews that I've certainly carried out in game. And
I had to record the moment
taking pictures from every angle, as I was looking slightly concerned at the direction that the conversation was taking.
I escorted Jeezy to the booth for that night, and I looked at the fear in John's eyes on what he was going to ask Jeezy. That's great. How is quarantine for you guys? I mean, it's got to be just, I mean, you guys travel, Darren and I travel. I mean, how has it been? Like, what are you doing to stay sane?
Well, I'm staying sane by locking myself in a house in England with all the other members of my family. We've got four kids, although that should be now in inverted commas, because they're aged 25 down to 17. So in fact, they're young adults. And we're only here by accident. So my wife, Anna, and I were on a trip back to the UK scheduled for 2 weeks, which we'd had the flights booked for months. And we were here. And by the time we got off the plane from Boston to London, President Trump had announced his latest travel restrictions. And as things stand, we can't come back. I have a work visa rather than a green card, so I'm now outside the country and unable to return at the moment. As you can see, Taylor is quite pleased by that. In fact, he's absolutely delighted, if we're being honest about it. So I don't know when I can come back. So we're locked down in the house that we kept in the UK when I moved to America. We very nearly decided to rent it out, and we would have been stateless and homeless then, but we do have somewhere. But let me tell you, when you invite your kids back, having been away at university and one of them's now in the world of work, you don't appreciate the challenges that are going to be culturally and just in terms of sort of meshing together, because they're not kids anymore. They're strongly opinionated young adults who are used to having their own space and their own way and doing what they want when they want. So the first 2 or 3 weeks of lockdown were particularly interesting in that regard. It's just beginning to simmer down a little now, but only now, a month and a half in.
And I like it, John. You're looking very erudite with your background there in the office. I was commenting before we came on air with, it looks like you've got the whole history of the cricket wisdom books in the background.
Yeah, I mean, I've got two rows of books behind me, and both of them have about 50 volumes in. One are these bright yellow books, which is the Cricket Bible, Wisdom Cricketing Almanac, which has been published every year since, I think, 1850-something. I have every edition since 1972. On my shelf, but what I'm actually prouder of is that the other row of books I've got are this deep dark blue, And that's the Rothmans Football Yearbook, first published in 1969, which is really the Bible, certainly, of the British football season. And it also takes in football from right around the world. And I have every single copy of those, very well thumbed, because prior to the internet age, they were the key facet to your research. So I add to that every year. I had to have my shelves extended behind me here by the carpenter that built them in the first place, because I've sort of survived a bit longer doing this than I thought I was going to do. So I need more space for more Rothmans and more Wisdoms, happily.
I was thinking, did you chat with Jeezy about them? That would have been a good conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he would have been floundering as much as I was if I introduced the concept of wisdom.
Hey, Taylor, do you understand the rules of cricket? Darren's tried to teach it, and I have no clue.
No, I just feel a little weird. I feel weird looking at my background compared to what John just said. I've got a bottle of Captain Morgan, proud sponsor of Major League Soccer, by me. I've got a really important bobblehead. Yep, Ron Burgundy. And I've got my only appearance with any kind of trophy. So I guess you could kind of figure out the intelligent one and the one you want to have a beer with. Actually, both of those are John, so I don't know what I'm offering. understand cricket. Matt, to answer your question, I don't understand cricket. Quite frankly, I don't really care.
Do you know the key reason that Taylor and cricket will never, ever interact successfully? Cricket is all about subtlety. And that's yes. I've tried to explain the meaning of subtlety to Taylor. I've been doing this for 2 or 3 years now, and he has no concept of subtlety.
I can't even spell that word, John.
Hey, talking of which, Matt, I'm just thinking with the cricket here and subtlety, we have a pop-up pub. So the way every month with Atlanta United, we used to do beers at the training ground. We now have to do it virtually. But we had one session where I tried to teach everyone cricket, and Carlos had a go at bowling, and he was hopeless. But we've got some great footage that we should show of him trying to hit the ball. He misses it and falls over trying to do it. So that's a good excuse, I think.
First off, Darren, you asked the guy that's built like a T-Rex, right? So he's 6'3". His arms can't even reach his stomach. That's how short his arms are. And you're asking him to try to play cricket. That's kind of unfair to Carlos Bocanegra, buddy.
It's true. He has got short hands. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. It's the same with
things. He does. He literally orders like a 38 extra short jacket for his Blazers.
He's going to love this. I had a question at the end. Give me a good Carlos Bocanegra, Brad Guzan story, so maybe we'll save that and you can give us another one at the end. That was going to be my final question. So you can think on that for a sec.
Yeah.
With no soccer, no sports, I mean, it's miserable for me. It's miserable for Darren. We've talked about it. You have the Jordan documentary, you had the draft. What are you guys watching? What are you doing? Because you guys watch so much soccer and sports, what are you watching now?
I think what's interesting, Matt and Darren, is that John has done – I mean, John's in London. Think of this, right? And so John came to me and was like, you know, we should still do stuff that we can. Now, listen, our production crew, with all seriousness, is making chicken salad out of chicken. You get my point. All of this on Zoom and the fact that we're producing shows, you know, I'm still – I still work. I do ESPN radio. I'm not watching a ton. I'm trying to catch up on shows that I never had time to watch. I miss the unpredictability of sports. That's the one thing I miss. You know, you can turn on any game and anything can happen. I know John and I are itching to do games again, but it's remarkable to me how much content John and I have been able to put out there for ESPN over the last 6 weeks while we're in two completely different worlds. So that's a real credit to our crew and the ability to do that. But I will say this, and I said this to John on text, I've never watched the NFL draft pass round 2. I can verbatim tell you what happened in round 6, 5, 6, and 7. I've never done it. I never will do it again. And yet this hunger for something, it's there. The Last Dance has been brilliant, but that was going to be brilliant no matter what. The fact that I was that engaged in the NFL draft for players that, you know, really I have no connection to, that is where I was like, you know what? I hope MLS comes back. I could care less where they play the games, on the surface of the sun in a parking lot. I think the fans are ready to see something. And I know John feels the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm passing my time. I can watch The Last Dance, albeit I have to watch it on, am I allowed to say Netflix? I have to watch
yes.
it on Netflix.
Yep.
In fact, the Netflix back catalogue has been hammered here. One of the great things, actually, has been watching Safe on Netflix, which is a Harlan Coben series. And Harlan Coben drops into our booth sometimes when we're doing MLS, because you know he spends a lot of his time in the UK, but also clearly is American, loves soccer, and is a very frequent visitor. So it's been a thrill to actually, having met the man, to see some of the stuff that he's done, which is utterly brilliant and really quite haunting and spooky. So my wife and I have enjoyed an awful lot of that. And the other really strange thing, without making myself seem too old, is that here, the networks have got no live sport to show, clearly, so they're showing a whole load of archive stuff. So I keep switching on the TV, just wondering what's on. And the other day I switched it on, and it was me doing an FA Cup semi-final in 1997 on BBC One. And you know, quite often people will be texting me, and maybe I'm out on my bike or having a walk or whatever, saying, "Oh, you're on the telly now," and I'll be thinking, "Well, am I? And what's the game?" It's a glorious sort of revealing of some of the matches that we did years ago. I mean, England Argentina from the World Cup in '98 was on here in the UK the other day, and I was lucky enough to do that. So, the strangest thing actually is that on a couple of occasions I've switched on and thought, oh, that looks like a good game, and the sound's not been up. And then I've switched the sound up, and I've actually realised at that point it was a game I did.
Because how do you critique yourself?
You've done so many matches, you forget. Sorry, Darren.
What's it like when you watch a game that you've commentated on?
Horrible, horrible.
You sort of feel like, oh, man, why did I say that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, all the time. I saw Richard Deitch in The Athletic did a terrific piece this
yes.
week with 25 play-by-play guys. So Al Michaels, Ian Eagle, all sorts of people. Ian Dark featured in the list as well. And they were asked about the call that they wish they could redo from their career. And it was fascinating because we all have calls that we would love to be able to redo, because our job really is a bit like a high wire act, live sports play-by-play without a safety net. And that's the thrill. It's where the adrenaline comes from, where the challenge emanates from. So
what's yours then, John?
Mine, I'd probably want to redo Beckham getting sent off in the World Cup in 1998. Because, I mean, everyone knows why he was sent off now, that little flick at Simeone. But because of the angles we were given at the time, no one was entirely sure in real time just why he'd been sent off until we started to see the replay. So I wish I'd been sharper on that. But I've also kind of learned over the years not to beat myself up too much. Otherwise, I'd just be a manic depressive, thinking of all the things I could have done better. But the worst thing of all, and this was... when I started in 1984, and it's the same now, I struggle to listen to my own voice.
Really?
It makes me cringe. And I just, sometimes I have to do it. And you do need to kind of monitor yourself from time to time to make sure you're not falling into too many bad habits. Mm-hmm. But I find it really difficult. So why anyone else should ever sit in front of the TV and listen to me for 90 minutes? I've no idea, because I can't do it myself.
And Taylor, what about you? Apart from your obvious hot take about Atlanta? Is there something you
honestly, Darren, everything I say, I stand by. I love, I appreciate. I love the sound of my voice. It resonates, you know, it's played throughout the entire house all the time. I enjoy, you know, my tone and my affection with certain words. Yeah, you know, when you've got a size 8.5 noggin, it just kind of fits the bill. I find the broadcasters that are real and authentic, if right or wrong, but they believe in it. I think it resonates with fans. That's why I enjoyed the Richard Deitch article, because you're talking some massive names here in the United States that would have never publicly admitted to anything. And yet you've got the Joe Bucks of the world saying, yeah, I didn't do this right. I actually disagree with John. I thought his call on the Beckham red card, because I remember this and I remember watching it. It was real. You know, you didn't have the – if the viewers at home, Darren and Matt, don't have the camera angles, then how can the broadcaster do that, right? And especially in a World Cup game where the listeners here aren't going to know, John could have been sitting on the roof. Like, FIFA doesn't do a wonderful job of putting everybody in a pristine spot the way we are at Mercedes-Benz. That's not how you call World Cup games. I've called a game almost in the nosebleeds of what you guys would do at the Benz. And you sit there and you rely on the monitors, because that's all you have. So but you do have to get used to the sound of your voice. And a lot of people can't stand it. I'm just very lucky I've got a great voice.
Taylor, you talked about being busy and working hard, which I know you are. You're popping up everywhere. You did a great article on the Forbes a couple of days ago, talking about how this sort of, this potential difficult situation could actually be a blessing for Major League Soccer. Is that something, you know, give me just a little bit of your thoughts on that and how you see it as an opportunity.
Darren, it's weird. Like, as critical as I can be as an announcer of games and whatnot, my entire playing career and personality is a glass is half full, right? And so I've always believed that. And I just look and assess and listen to the people over in Europe and in South America. And when I hear, listen, everyone's losing money. So I want to make that abundantly clear. This is difficult for everyone. However, there's this gap that we talk about with Major League Soccer and the rest of the world. And I think this is an opportunity. And I've said this, Darren, on SportsCenter. And so the listeners may have not heard it, but that may mean changing the schedule. This may be an opportunity where you adjust the schedule. Whatever it is, if you are proactive in addressing this pandemic and the ability to change and actually look at it as an opportunity, Darren, John and I have talked about this a numerous amount of times. Is there going to be a transfer window? Probably. What's that going to look like? There's going to be a lot more sellers than there are buyers. And so if you can buy something at 60 cents to a dollar, can you bridge that gap? I think Major League Soccer can. I'm not saying the owners aren't losing money. It's not what I'm saying. But in relation to the rest of the world, I think Major League Soccer, 4, 5, 6 years down the road, John, I don't know what you think, but I just feel like we may reflect on this and say, wow, that's where Major League Soccer actually took advantage of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, my take for what it's worth, Darren, is that the MLS is uniquely placed, really, at the moment because of the nature of the ownership of all the clubs and the fact that so many of the owners have got such deep pockets. So I contrast it. I'm obviously watching from a distance, but in touch with many people. And, yeah, we're all waiting for the green light for MLS to restart in some form again. But sitting here in Europe and talking to people I know around Europe, as I'm sure you do as well, here it's more an existential crisis for a number of reasonably high-profile clubs in high-profile leagues. And I'm not hearing that in MLS. It doesn't seem like this is going to threaten the very existence of Major League Soccer or its constituent parts. But here in Europe, it is. I mean, the clubs outside the Premier League, many of the executives will be well known to you, Darren. You know, this is a life and death situation for them, a life and death struggle. And I don't get the impression that's the case in MLS. So I just think that there are foundations and a financial structure within MLS that's actually going to benefit it going forward when the other leagues in many other countries are bleeding heavily.
Yeah, it's interesting what you guys say, and not to minimise, obviously, the issues that are going on. But I've been using another famous Englishman, John, Sir Winston Churchill, where he said, difficulties mastered are opportunities won. And I think you guys hit the nail on the head. What we have with MLS compared to Europe, firstly, actually, we don't have the history, which is sometimes baggage that makes it very difficult for you to make changes. Right? We can be nimble, agile. We can adapt to the circumstances. We don't have relegation, which is a huge factor because, you know, that's one of the problems you've got in Europe, where any changes you're trying to make or finishing a season early causes, you know, umbrage at the bottom end of the table. It's been really fascinating. We have a part ownership of Aberdeen in Scotland, of which I'm a member of the board there. And so seeing some of the difficulties they're going through, and to your point, John, some of those clubs that are just facing going to the wall just because of this situation. I do think, you know, it's not to minimize the global situation, but I feel like if we can get to the other side of this, it does give an opportunity for Major League Soccer to step up in the world football ranks and sort of take that perhaps quantum leap that we haven't been able to before, which will be, you know, which would be great if we could do that.
But even so, Darren, on the near term, let's say what these closed door games, if Major League Soccer looks at it and is very, they address it and acknowledge that it's a novelty, you can open up some eyeballs for fans that have never seen this and embraced it. There's an opportunity here because everyone has such a hunger and thirst for live sports. You're going to get a lot of non-soccer people watching these games and these broadcasts. I just think there's an opportunity there. And listen, obviously, I'll admit it when I'm wrong. This one, I don't think I am. I do believe Major League Soccer, when we get to the 22 World Cup and then the 26 World Cup, I just think we're going to reflect on this and say, you know what? There's a group of owners that grabbed everyone else by their hands, drug them through the dirt, and got through all of this and said, you know what? We're going to be stronger for it. It would not surprise me whatsoever.
Yeah, it was. It's been interesting because we've obviously got the first little step, the return to individual training. And we were able to, at Lanch United on Wednesday, have that first step towards getting on the training pitch. And the level of interest, because we're in a world where there's absolutely bugger all going on. I mean, it's been incredible in terms of that footage and where that will be shown and where it will be seen, because, you know, we are able to take that step. So again, I think to your point, Taylor, we can get out there and get some content out there and perhaps try a few innovative ideas, then I think this is a is something to try and take opportunity of.
I agree.
Yeah, and you know, as Darren said, you know, in my world, you know, people were so hungry for that social content of, you know, when we put the players on the pitch the first day and seeing how we were doing it and how we were doing, you know, being safe and social distancing. They were so hungry for it. I mean, it, the engagement on that day, just seeing players speak for the first time in a while, has been really well received. So you can tell people are definitely hungry for it. It's good. Well, hey, a couple more things. One thing Darren and I like to ask people, and I was really curious when you guys, because you go to so many, we'd like to know your other than MBS, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, we'd like to know your favorite stadium, and we'd like to know the first stadium you ever attended.
Okay.
Ooh, go ahead, John.
Okay. It's interesting you asked that, because I had to write the foreword to a book this week, which is being published by the club I grew up watching in my home city, in York, in the north of England, York City. And they were the first team that I covered as well. So the first ground that I ever went to was Bootham Crescent, the home of York City. It's a place where I've seen them beat. They're a side, I should explain, with a great cup fighting tradition. So even in my time, I've either seen or broadcast them beating Manchester United there, Arsenal, Everton, Chelsea. I've seen them draw twice with Liverpool. So there have been some good moments, but they're now in the sixth tier of English football, and they're about to leave Bootham Crescent for a new community stadium, which may well prove to be a mixed blessing. But it's a city centre ground. York is an ancient Roman city. The stadium is 5 minutes walk from York Minster, the cathedral right in the heart of the city. So it's in a wonderful position. It was so close to the house where I grew up with my parents that on a Saturday afternoon, I could hear the roar of the crowd. I could see the floodlights from my bedroom. And just one story on that. I saw my first ever game there at the age of 12. It was against Newport County in the fourth division of English football. I was part of a crowd of 1,971. The goal scorers were Peter Scott, a Northern Ireland international who used to play for Everton, and a guy called Gordon Staniforth, who became well known for playing when Plymouth reached the semi-finals of the FA Cup some years later. York won 2-0. I was smitten. I remember the sway of the crowd, such as the crowd was. I remember the smell of the liniment as I walked in behind the main stand. I remember the taste of the Bovril, which is a very peculiar beef drink that we have in the United Kingdom, which is synonymous, Darren, with going to football. But linked in with that, that was actually 8 years after my first ever visit to the ground, because I went to the school that abutted the stadium. I started at the age of four, and on my first day at school, there was a game of football, soccer, in the playground at lunchtime involving all the big kids, and the little kids were the ones that were told to go and get the ball back when it was booted over the wall of the playground into the football stadium. So I remember at the age of four and a half with a couple of my little mates on our first day at school being dispatched into this football ground to go and get the ball back and meeting the wrath of the groundsman, the grounds curator, who really didn't want to see us at all and, you know, was shouting at us and telling us what was going to happen to us if we ever appeared on his turf again. So that basically is the first ground I ever went to. If you're asking me for my favourite stadium in an American context, other than MBS, I'm going to go Providence Park, because I love the history. You can almost taste it when you walk in that place. It's great.
What about you, Taylor? What was your first stadium?
God, this is... So St. Louis Soccer Park would be... So you got to keep in mind, my dad played in the NASL. So obviously my first stadium was probably 2, 3, 4 years old, chasing him around, you know, doing that stuff. But take that out of the equation. First game I remember, St. Louis Soccer Park, I'm going to say 1988, 1989, World Cup qualifier and Olympic qualifier. You know, it seats 5,000. They let 8,500 in. This is right before the 1990 World Cup. My father was just retired right in, like, I'm going to say 84, 85. And then he became a VP at Umbro. So he was following that, just that kind of thing. I remember seeing Alexi Lalas in that stadium. So that would be my first memory of a soccer game in that stadium. Now that's the home of the St. Louis USL franchise. Obviously, the MLS franchise is going to play in a new stadium downtown. My favorite stadium outside of MLS is Borussia Dortmund, hands down. Played there. Something very unique. And actually, some of the MLS new stadiums are trying, you know, they're not doing it the same magnitude. But when you see that many people behind a goal, and you're the center forward going that way, the whole thing's just remarkable. For me, right now in Major League Soccer, it's Minnesota United's new place. There's something about, if you blindfolded me, put me in there, I feel like I'm in a mid-level Bundesliga stadium, like in the eastern part of Germany. That's not a shot at St. Paul, but it kind of is. just there's something about that stadium. The roof, John and I were there for the opener. It was electric. I've been there for a U.S. Gold Cup game. It's loud in there. The playoff game was Zlatan. There's something very unique about that. And obviously, I've got history. I was born in Minneapolis. My father played for the Kicks. But I do love that stadium. There's something special about it. I like Bank of California Stadium, but their camera positions and their thought process of trying to help television, not good enough.
Because we've yet to play there. We haven't actually played at the stadium.
It's brilliant. I have to commend Taylor, because I've heard many, many tributes to Minnesota United's new ground, but it's the first I've ever heard that hasn't mentioned the beer hall with 96 taps behind the goal. So well done.
And look, we're wrapping up, but I did. My last question, Taylor, I'd love to, you know, have a little dirt on Brad Guzan and Carlos Buchenegger. You got anything good? You thought about
it? Well, I've known Carlos since he was 16, 17. that was right before he was in the 98 Degrees boy band, if you recall. no, there's nothing. Hey, listen, you're not going to get a lot of anything, any dirt I have on Carlos. No, that's it stays here. Brad, I'll tell you a quick story about Brad. Brad got called into the national team, and he was wearing this mouth guard. And I'm like, who wears only a goalkeeper would wear a stupid mouth guard, right? And in his lip, he still hates me for this, but the lip would just be swollen all the time. And I finally started to figure out, he made more saves with his face, his rookie year, than I've ever seen a goalkeeper make. So that's why he needed the mouth guard. So he would come into the bus, he'd start talking like he had an orange peel in his mouth. He couldn't understand. So, Brad, I was there for the beginning of Brad Guzan's career, and it's cool to see how well he's turned out, and the fact that he's surgically repaired the lip, it looks better. His missus appreciates it now, because he now doesn't look like a complete idiot. But Brad and Carlos are good people, guys you wanted in your locker room, 100%.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for your time, guys. I know you guys are busy. I know you're like you said, you're doing a lot of content, and it's great stuff. We enjoy it. It's good to still hear about soccer, and we can't wait to see you back at the Benz very, very soon, hopefully sooner than later. And you know, thanks for all you do for us and for the league. We really appreciate it.
John, do we have to wear pants if we go back to the Benz?
Why is it everything is lowest common denominator with you? Thank you.
No, seriously, thanks, guys. We've had people like Michael Vick on the podcast, but to have, I think, the greatest soccer duo in football since Waddle and Hoddle, it's been great to have you guys on, so appreciate
that. That's a dubious compliment. Thank you very much, Darren.
Thank you so much, guys, and stay safe.
Yeah, no problem. See you, boys. Good seeing you guys.